Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Often people can feel maybe awkward reaching into a bereaved person. I think in these extraordinary times, the message is, you know, sort of suck it up. Don't feel so bad about it. Try. But the worst thing a person could say is, I'm not up for a chat just now.
So on this episode of the podcast, we are joined by Orla Keegan, who is the head of education and bereavement services for the Irish Hospice Foundation. And she speaks to us all about how staff in hospitals and hospices and nursing homes are dealing with this and how they're finding different ways to help families cope with this transition, whether it be through video calls or phone calls or different ways that they can share in those last moments together, which is really unimaginable for the staff that they're having to learn this so fast, but also for the families having to adjust to not being able to go to a funeral and watching it on their phone. I mean, this is something that if you had said this to us a few months ago, that you'd be watching a funeral on a phone as a common experience, I don't think any of us would have believed that.
Or wanted to believe it.
Yeah.
A lot of people do, as we talked with Gus Nichols and John Stafford before, like they do FaceTime Live funerals or Insta Live funerals for people who can't be there. But now the fact that that is the norm is almost horrific, because it is the hug at the funeral. It's, from my own experience, it was the people who turned up that you'd least expect. Well, not least expect, you just didn't surprise. And I think it's also the huge comfort of knowing how, when people turn up to a funeral, knowing that you're not alone and how much you love that person. Yeah. And that so many other people love that person too. And that's a tremendously helpful thing, that moving forward, to know, whereas now they're being denied that.
They are. And I think Orla speaks in a really wonderful way about how grief is going to change, and it is changing, how our coping is changing, how maybe our traditions will change as well around how we mark a death. I noticed recently Facebook have launched like a Zoom-like thing where people can go on and have a group chats on video. And I think you might see people honoring the person there. They might be doing it on Zoom. They might be doing it in all different ways. Mm. But we thank Orla so much for joining us and talking about this very difficult, difficult time and how it's changing our world. The COVID-19 outbreak has touched the lives of thousands of families across Ireland, and more than ever before, the prospect of an unexpected loss is a growing concern for many. Grief is complicated even on the best of days, but now our lives are restricted in so many ways, and the way we grieve has changed dramatically. Our guest today, Orla Keegan, Head of Education and Bereavement Services for the Irish Hospice Foundation, joins us today to talk a little bit about all these huge changes that are happening. Thanks for coming on the podcast, Orla.
Thanks, Sasha.
I guess the first question is, none of us were ready for this. and I can't imagine that you guys were either. No. I mean, it must be a huge thing to take on when grief and loss changes so dramatically overnight for the world.
Absolutely. And I suppose, I mean, in the Hospice Foundation, we're in an unusual position. Like, we're a support organization, and we're an information and education organization, and we do a lot of public engagement. But as you said, this tsunami has arrived, and it's put us back on thinking, oh, well, which of our advice is still current? How is this extremely different situation going to actually play out for people? We don't know how long it will last. We don't know if any of the restrictions will change or become more severe, and that was certainly a worry at the early days. We know, I suppose, we did a lot of thinking about it, and we know at the end of the day that even an expected death comes as a shock to people when it actually happens. There are some maybe similarities in the patterns. We know that grief is all about adjustment and adjusting your life and accommodating into a brand new life. And that's hard because none of us invite in change. And I suppose we also know that the support of others is really important in grieving. So we did agree that those lines still stand. And then we were looking at, well, what's changed? And I think a number of big changes would be the extent to which you were able to be present for the person who died before the death. And even if it worked out that you were able to be there, I think the fear of not being able to be there was very heightened for people. And then
there must be something that's very heightened for both the person that is dying, because in the mindset that they would be in at that point, how much or how little do they know of what's actually going on and why their loved ones can't be there with them?
That's it. I mean, and I suppose, well, we know that in Ireland, a large number of people die every day anyway, and some of them will be acknowledging that they are dying, and some will not be able to maybe accommodate or understand that that's what's happening to them. So we're trying to focus on all of those deaths, as well as people who may be dying of COVID, because every death in Ireland has been affected by this in terms of who can be around them. There's a lot of work being done, I suppose, in terms of, particularly for people, say, in nursing homes and in hospitals, as to how you can connect in without being physically there and physically visiting, in order that you can keep company with people. If they can converse, obviously, what we're doing now, having a Zoom meeting or a FaceTime, is very important. Phone calls, older people might be more comfortable with. If two-way communication is a challenge, there are still other things we can do, making sure that a person's favourite music is available to them, maybe doing a voice recording and having that available, or more symbolic things. So one of the lovely example from the UK, and I think they're now doing it in one of the hospitals here, is providing little handmade hearts, and one goes to the family and one stays with the person who's approaching the end of their life.
It must be very difficult without human touch at the end.
Well, that's it, and I think any of us would, you know, in your wildest dreams, in terms of what you would like for the end of your own life, you want people to be there. We're, as a foundation, we recommend that all of the organisations would work, like that's hospitals and nursing homes, would work insofar as it's absolutely possible to make sure that there's one person there with someone who's dying. Again, touch is through PPE equipment, so it's a different type of touch now. But I think to bear witness to a death is such an important privilege and an important role in a family. I mean, that one person who's there then becomes the, I suppose, the caretaker of that ending, and that they have to transmit that and communicate it to the family. So there really is something important about being able to be there and bear witness, acknowledging how difficult it is.
This must be an unbelievably difficult transition for the staff, because so quickly they're learning, as someone who has experienced hospice with both of my parents, the staff play such a huge role anyway, but to play even more of a role, to play this essential role, these are the people that are surrounding you. How has that been, that transition, to try and teach them, first of all, about these new ways of communication and these new procedures and these, but also just emotionally supporting them? It must be very difficult.
I think there's no doubt about it, you know, that we're all humans first before we take on any profession. And again, if we think about who are the staff, I mean, you've mentioned hospice, but we could also talk about acute hospitals and nursing homes and community hospitals. So the people who make a difference to individual patients and their families are not just the doctors and the nurses and the specialists. They are also the, you know, the cleaning staff, there's the care assistants, there's the cooks, the people who bring humanity, and all of those have been affected as well. I think, again, it's about heart. The motivation to do the right thing has been a huge resource to people in their learning about what to do. So they're curious, they're actively looking for ideas on what to do. In hospitals, for example, the social workers have come together and they have developed a whole range of resources for different things that they might do and encourage other staff to do. And that could range from, you know, practical tips on communicating through to maybe just small visualizations that a patient can use to summon a family, you know, to say, you're there for me just beyond the door, and to connect through the heart. And that is a very different way of working, you know, a virtually mediated love rather than a face-to-face love.
I have a friend who's a nurse and has been witness to, sadly, a lot of people passing in the last few weeks. And, you know, he goes home to his wife and his two kids and carries that with him, you know, as the week goes on. What sort of support do staff have? Because it seems that suddenly, whereas in a hospice, yes, you would expect to be on the front face of people dying, because unfortunately that's the nature of where they're working. But what support are they getting?
And again, I'd say in hospice, because of their practice and their focus, there's a very good baseline for understanding the impact that individual deaths can have on staff members, and for ways of looking after yourself, but also having the organization to support you. So maybe team debriefings, employee assistance programs, and so on. It's arguable that those practices aren't as developed in other areas where we're now seeing the huge volume of deaths. And we know that they've been happening in nursing homes and in hospitals. So in fairness, the HSE have been doing a lot in terms of putting resources in place through the managers. And some of them, like, for example, St. James's Hospital has a dedicated support line that staff can use just as individuals to debrief. All of them have employee assistance programs that they have access to. And I think it's worth saying that this is still going on. So it's about developing a medium to long-term approach to help staff feel supported and feel, I suppose, individually resourced as they re-enter their careers, because everybody works on crisis and adrenaline for a while, and you can manage that. But as things begin to, I suppose, plateau out, that's the potential of things actually revisiting And I hear you about your friend going back to their family. You're bringing really the sort of things that other folk will never see in their whole life.
No.
Bringing them with you into your family. And sometimes you need that for respite, you know, and to be able to look at the positives and the nurturing part of your family and keep your work part away. And so there's in different ways.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In terms of grief, Orla, this is something that I've been thinking a lot about. You know, obviously our podcast and why we created it was to sort of get people to be talking about grief more and sharing their grief and their experiences and being more open about it so that they didn't feel as alone. But I worry, I'm very worried, to be honest, that this will push things backwards in a way, because people are experiencing grief in isolation. So they're not able to meet a friend for coffee and sit down. Mm. And sometimes you do have, sometimes, look, anyone who's ever experienced grief knows that it doesn't just always just come pouring out the minute that someone picks up the phone to you. Sometimes you need the cappuccino or the drink in front of you for a little while before you're willing to kind of open up. And we're really, people are in very different mm-hmm. circumstances mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. How are you guys thinking yeah. about that?
Yeah, and I you're exactly right, because that's the second major differentiation between what's happening now. Like, you know, you could say grieving is like private and emotional, but the process of grief and how we cope with it is social. Mm. And one of the things that usually helps us in the early times is the script of the funeral, you know, so the wake yes. and the funeral, and all of those yeah. are collective pieces. So while they might have functions of helping you come to the reality of the death and helping in the transition of a person from being physically in your life to being more in the heart of your life, the third function of them are to provide comfort. And that's just not there in the same yeah. way. And that's a secondary loss, if you like, to the bereaved mm. person, because they would have always assumed that was there for them. Mm. Now, people are reaching in. You know, there are other ways, and particularly around in the early days after a death. So you find people are making extra efforts to, you know, to text, to connect, mm. To phone. But you have precisely put your finger on it there, Sasha. It's over time. How does this mm. connection maintain? And I suppose if there's one message that people could take away in terms of support, the thing I always think about is be persistent in your support. Mm. So think of the person in the weeks and the months after. Provide some of those spontaneous spaces to have a chat. Mm. And often people can feel maybe awkward reaching into a bereaved person. I think in these extraordinary times, the message is, you know, sort of suck it up. Don't feel so bad about it. Try. The worst thing a person could say is, I'm not up for a chat just now. Mm. Persist. And I guess the other piece is that to some extent, it does put an extra sort of choice or burden on the bereaved person to also reach out. So if you have been getting cards or texts or phone calls, answer them. Maybe, you know, say, great, maybe we'll talk next week. And then initiate some of these conversations. You know, it's not what you'd expected you would have to do. But these are options sort of available to you. Mm. And the other thing, actually, sorry for rabbiting on, but the other piece that I've noticed is people are contacting folk that they haven't necessarily talked to in a long while. Mm. You know, so it's an opportunity to reconnect. So people who maybe you worked with years ago, who would have known the person who died, and they might have liked to have known, but because of the natural network not operating as effectively, they haven't found out that a person has died. You know, make a point of helping people to know what's happened to you. And because you have so much time on your hands, I think that's the other bit.
How important is it as well, Orla, I think, to remember as well the people that, it, you know, as Sasha was saying, that it's not just 6 months down the line, but it could be 2 years down the line. And it could be, like, we've a significant birthday on Saturday, and I know it's Martin not being here is playing very much in our minds because we're at home and we've plenty of time to think. And that even becomes more isolating because at this point, there's almost an expectation that, well, it's the third time they've done the birthday, you know, they're in a better place or whatever. But no matter how much you might have thought you'd move forward, suddenly you feel like you've taken so many steps backward.
Absolutely, yeah, and you're locked into that, yeah. So you know any of the choices or distractions that you might have decided to say, look, this year we're going to do something different, that bit of choice has been taken from you, so I think people can find that coming in on them as an extra layer. You're so right, and I think we need to be careful not to develop like a hierarchy of grief, that it's the grief at this time that is maybe worse and so significantly important. Of course it's horrendous and it's horrible, but on an individual basis, everybody's grief counts, and that's the one you're dealing with, and that's the one you're maybe revisiting and trying to work with in the confines of your own apartment or your own home or your own kitchen. If there's anything, I'll go back to it, let people reach in to you, Venetia, now. Yeah, you've said it, good. Let your friends and acquaintances say, God, yeah, maybe I'll give her a text or I'll write her a note. And people should start to try and, I think, act on their heart, because while we're saying that the community is obviously assaulted with all these changes and feeling that the sort of the ground has been wiped from under them because everything we assumed is right about the way death happens and the way grieving happens has been rattled. Maybe the plus side of that is I do think that people's hearts are open now in communities. Mm. We're talking about, you listen to the media, you look at the newspapers, we're very death sensitive now and people want to help. So maybe it's up to us to give them some just steers on what they can do.
Do you feel, Orla, that we might see some interesting developments in terms of how we, like, once this is over, and I know everyone keeps talking about once this is over and we don't know when that is.
It's a favorite phrase.
Once this is over. Mm. But obviously there will be developments and it will change. Do you think we might see an increase in Ireland in terms of, like, less traditional ways of marking a death, so maybe memorial services or ways that people, like, will people go back and look at, I hope they do, where instead of just saying, look, no one got to go to the funeral and that's that and we just move on, that maybe we might have small gatherings, we might have ways that we develop our relationship with that process.
It's an interesting one, and again I think it relates to the notion of time, because when you're normally planning a funeral or a memorial, you're doing it in a couple of days, whereas now people will have weeks and months, you know, to plan such a thing. And they could well take different shapes. And the idea is that they're, you know, they're going to be different. I'd imagine they probably become more celebratory and more in honor and in tribute to the person who died, which makes me think then that we need to be doing maybe smaller types of memorials in the meantime. I don't know that we should put everything off for 6 months or a year. So obviously there's been some developments around maybe streaming funerals and that sort of thing. But again, families could look at, having maybe a virtual connection or a virtual ritual of their own where they come together. So again, not necessarily mediated by a celebrant, but something where they say, like on a Saturday night, we're all going to play this piece of music, light a candle, come together later for a chat. You know, so doing things that are symbolic and very meaningful to that family and to the person who died. I think there's such an important role to that coming together that we shouldn't put it off entirely. And people are being creative.
Yeah. When we first started this over a year ago, there was this huge stigma around grief and talking about grief and how we deal with grief in Ireland. And since then, just in general, a conversation seems to have opened up about, how we approach grief, how we talk to the person who's bereaved, all that sort of stuff. Now, as you said, it's on the forefront of everybody's minds because, you know, everybody is being touched by the fact that people can't be with their loved ones when they're dying and the dying can't be with their loved ones. Can there be a good thing out of this that we actually start talking about it and becoming more open about grief when the person is living?
I think so. I think that equates to empathy and that's there for tapping. I think there might be some other maybe more directed things that we could do is to talk about the variety of ways that people experience grief, because, you know, talking will be really important to some people. They need to rework the story of what happened, and they need to be emotional with their trusted friends and have a I suppose what we tend to think about grief is as real sadness, whereas grief is more than just sadness. And some people may not outwardly talk, they might do things in their grief. So we talk about people who feel their grief and people who do their grief or act out their grief, and that's as valid a way of grieving. So, for example, and sometimes this is looked at around gender lines, you know, that some people, just men in particular, may not be as expressive as women. It doesn't mean that they're not grieving, they're finding different ways of channeling that grief.
I think typically for a guy, from my own experience, as Sasha was saying earlier about going for a drink with guys, and I don't mean to generalize, but it's just my own experience, that it would be going to the pub, having a few drinks, and then it comes out. Whereas women would be much more chatty on the phone and texting.
Exactly. We call that sort of styles of grief. And like you said, it's not necessarily just guys, but some women have that style as well. They're just not expressive.
So for those people who rely, I suppose, on maybe the little bit of Dutch courage, shall we say, to open up, like, what would you say to them?
Well, I mean, it's clear that alcohol and drugs aren't a good coping strategy over time. But also what you would say to them is, well, how is your grief? What's the hardest thing about it? And how does it work out for you? You know, what is it like grieving? And they might say, well, the worst thing is that I don't know how to manage the children in the way my wife would have. Very practical things about being there for them, and sometimes that can be the way a thinker or a planner or an organizer channels their grief into trying to solve this type of problem, that their emotional need is not as high as their need to, take back some control. Those people might be more inclined to maybe work out their grief through exercise or physically energizing themselves in that way. And that's valid. I suppose the bursts through alcohol are valid, of course, but it doesn't mean they're not grieving the rest of the time. It's that we don't always acknowledge that as grief, because we all have a relatively singular idea about what grief is. But grief happens in our body and in our thoughts, as much as in our feelings. So I think we could acknowledge that.
We've talked a lot about how anger plays a role too, because, you know, this might sound really naive. I know it sounds naive, but anger was a surprise to me. I was very surprised. Maybe because I wasn't like an angry person leading up to, I wasn't familiar with it, but boy did I become very familiar with it. And I couldn't believe it. And I didn't like it. I really didn't like it, because I didn't know how to handle it. Mm-hmm. In these circumstances, I'm making presumptions because I haven't gone through it in these circumstances, but I would imagine anger will play a role too, because of the lack of control. So if you're dealing with not being there when the person dies, even though it's not your fault, even though there's nothing that could be done to avoid it, you still might find you're angry at yourself, or you're angry at the world at large because this thing happened.
And that this is not the way you wanted it to be. And I think the important thing is that you don't judge yourself for that anger, and you allow yourself it. Because sometimes some of our feelings aren't as sort of palatable or as acceptable as others. So anger, irritability, which are valid types of grief, might be harder to express, or might be harder for other people to accept. And they want to say, no, don't be angry. I know you couldn't manage it, but it's not your fault. And they shut down the expression of it. So it really is to allow it as a just and a reasonable response. And you're angry at the world, you know, it's not blame so much as anger. So it should be allowed.
Venetia, I just wanted to say, you know, the work that you guys are doing, it's really remarkable, because I can't imagine what it's like to have to think on your feet this fast. And I can't imagine what it's like to be a place that people turn to in a time like this, because there's so many more people engaging with what you do and looking at what you do and looking at resources and looking for, you know, it's got to be really overwhelming. And so from my perspective, I thank you guys for everything that you're doing, because it's not an easy position to be in right now. I guess we'll all be learning going forward as to what the next stages are with this. But thank you so much for joining us and for taking the time out to talk about all this.
No problem at all. Thanks, Sasha.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.